Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Now we will go to a song, Golden Bough by Virginia Ackley.
Moonlight, lady.
Greetings and welcome back to Voice of Olympus. Today's guest is Tony Mrzewicki. Tony developed a fascination for ancient religions, which led him to immerse himself in the study of ceremonial magic. He has presented workshops and rituals for creating ancient magical and religious practices in the United States and Australia. He's the author of Greco-Egyptian Magic and Hellenismos, and has contributed to various anthologies. Currently has a blog on Patheos, is a panelist on the Living Theurgy podcast, and hosts the Living Hellenismos podcast. He has also been featured extensively in other media. And now, without further ado, Tony Mrzewicki. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
Hi, Hercules. I'm doing well. How have you been? And thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to learning about how you heard the call to Olympus and how you responded.
For me, it actually started with Hollywood movies.
Oh, wow.
Believe it or not. Yeah, as a kid, I used to watch a lot of television, like I suppose a lot of kids did back in the day, and I found myself being very drawn to Greek-themed movies. So in particular, you know, all the sword and sandal movies, which would feature Hercules, Jason and the Argonauts, Clash of the Titans, both the original and the remake. There was even a cartoon series about Hercules.
Yes, I remember.
And then later on there was a series on Hercules, and then there was a spin-off series, Xena Warrior Princess, both of which were filmed in New Zealand. There was Troy, which featured Brad Pitt. There was Alexander, which featured Colin Farrell and Angelina Jolie, Val Kilmer, Anthony Hopkins. The Percy Jackson movies, Wonder Woman even. The Percy Jackson movies are actually very interesting, both the movies and the books, because quite a lot of young kids found themselves being drawn to the Greek gods because of the Percy Jackson movies. So just as a lot of kids found themselves being brought to witchcraft via the Harry Potter books, so many found themselves brought to the Greek gods through the Percy Jackson books.
Yes, the gods have always been alive in popular culture, even in antiquity. We forget that Homer was an entertainer, as were the playwrights who preserved many of these myths. Hercules and the other heroes and the gods and the monsters of Olympus, they were on cups and saucers and craters and, all sorts of dinnerware, as well as in statues and in art. So the gods were very much a part of popular entertainment, even back in the day.
Exactly. It's much like merchandising today. So just as people may get into a particular movie or a particular band or what have you, and they go off and buy merchandising, it was the same thing in ancient times. Like you said, you could buy cups with paintings and etchings of various gods and the like. And, you know, over the years, I found a number of Hellenic reconstructionists complaining that there are departures from established myths. And the point is that Hollywood movies are reinventions of the myths. Just as there are so many different myths to be found if you look at the writings of ancient Greece. So Hollywood basically reinvent myths. They're not documentaries. It's not like they're taking established myths and trying to present those. They're trying to present something fresh and new. But the point is, out of the thousands and thousands of people who watch those movies, there are going to be few who are going to think, wow, this is pretty cool. I want to find out more. And so those movies will then serve as a gateway, and they can reach far more people than say, you know, we can with a podcast like this.
Right.
Because they entertain.
And there were many versions of the myths in antiquity as well. There wasn't an orthodox version. There were several versions circulating. and from location to location within the greater Magna Graecia of the Roman Empire or throughout the Mediterranean, you might find variations. Like, for instance, in some Etruscan variations, like in the Disney movie, Hercules was the son of Zeus and Hera. And in those Etruscan versions, he married Athena, and Ares was one of their sons. So there were lots of these different versions floating around. There are several different versions of the Argonautica as well.
Exactly. Exactly. There was no one established mythos. So just as the ancients took license with the myths, I think we're entitled to as well.
Yes,
my approach to the myths is that they give you a fascination for the ancient gods, and then using them as a prism, you start to approach those gods and then develop a relationship with them. I mean, that's my thing, to familiarize yourself with the Greek gods and develop a relationship with them, so then you find out the reality underlining the myths. And everyone's relationship with the gods is going to be slightly different. That's the beautiful thing about it.
I believe the same as well. It's a relationship, and all relationships are different and unique. So even though there are types of relationships, and there are, I always liken it to dating, that, a lot of the ceremonial that we have for the gods is kind of like dating rituals. You know, it's when you're trying to establish the relationship, and if you're trying to respect the relationship by doing something special, but it's the relationship that's important, not the buying of the flowers and things like that.
Exactly. That's actually a really good way of looking at things. And over the years, I've seen people talk about the sort of offerings that they make to the various gods. So, for instance, you know, some people might say that they will offer chocolate to Aphrodite or one of the female goddesses. And you think, well, they didn't have chocolate in ancient Greece. But the point is that the person saying that they're using chocolate as an offering, they find that it works for them.
Right.
That is part of their relationship. And no one's in any position to sort of say, well, what you're doing is wrong. If a particular approach works for you and it brings you closer to a particular goddess, then go for it. I get communications from people occasionally, and, you know, one guy's asked me about, you know, the best offerings for a particular god and all that, and my attitude is start off with the basic stuff, like the most popular offering in ancient Greece was a granule of frankincense. Offer the frankincense. Try to see what sort of messages you channel, develop a relationship, and in the end, you're going to be told what to offer to the various gods. And everyone's relationship is going to be slightly different. That's the beauty of it.
Yes.
There's no one governing body that tells you what the standard offering is for each particular god. There's no one way of worshipping the gods. The fact is that the way the gods were worshipped varied from province to province, from time to time, and also social group to social group. So you had the huge public rituals where everyone was invited. You had the smaller rituals for various fratries, various working groups, and then you had the rituals in the home. So you had particular home traditions, and the way you worship the gods was at home was the way your father worshipped the gods and your grandfather worshipped the gods. The Greeks were incredibly conservative. They would keep doing things exactly the same way, unless there was a very good reason to change things.
In my family, as in many of the Greek families whose house I visited, there's something called an iconostasi, or an icon stand, in each home. And each home has usually the saints of your family, where the names are repeated from generation to generation. And then you also have any special saints that have significance to the family. But in every iconostasi I've ever seen, there are also the ancient Olympians. Like two of my aunts have passed on. I inherited one of my aunts, Hermes's, and another one of my aunts, Aphrodite and Adonis. So these things get passed on, and they get mixed in with the more Greek Orthodox symbolism. The Greeks, even though the majority of them are Greek Orthodox, stubbornly hold on to the past, and they're proud of the past. So it's not surprising that these things are part of the home worship as well.
They should hold on to the past. The Greek past was absolutely magnificent. The statues, the culture, all the contributions that the Greeks made, democracy, science, philosophy. It's something that the Greeks should be proud of, and it's something they should hold on to. I think it's very wrong that the Orthodox Church forcibly imposed Christianity onto the Greeks, much as the Church imposed Christianity in other nations as well, brutally suppressing pagan practices. My attitude is that you find the spiritual modality you're most comfortable with. And if you want to be Christian, great, but don't try to impose it on other people. If you're far happier venerating the Greek gods, then venerate the Greek gods, and you should be able to do that without being molested by others, without being told that what you're doing is wrong, is inappropriate, is heretical.
In my growing up, we were sent to parochial school, but it was recognized that some people have affinity with the more ancient gods. So the way it was handled, at least in my upbringing, was that it was clear to everyone that I was attuned to Olympus. So they would tell me that there's a heaven of virtuous pagans, and I'll probably go there, if not to Olympus itself, but that the gods of each religion let you visit your family because they're not heartless.
Yes, that's actually a really beautiful belief.
Yes.
It wasn't something instilled in me, sadly. It was a case of you had to be Catholic. You had to be a devout Catholic. And it was only Catholics who go to heaven. Yeah, they grudgingly admit Orthodox practitioners. And as you probably realize, as a Catholic, if you're supposed to attend Holy Communion, you're supposed to receive Holy Communion. If you cannot find a Catholic church, it's okay for you to go to an Orthodox church and receive communion there. So it was almost like the Orthodox Church was presented as, it's sort of the second rung down from the Catholics.
Right.
So that's how I was brought up anyway. I don't accept any of that now. I'm a great believer in just letting people find their own path and follow that.
I also believe the same thing, that each of us is unique, and just like our relationship to the divine are going to be unique, our path is going to be unique as well. And just like I view rituals and the deities as kind of like dating advice or dating etiquette, I view the practice of my spirituality the same way I view working out at the gym. That basically, every relationship, every particular path that you choose in life in whatever sphere requires work if you actually want to walk that path. So you have to devote time and energy to it.
Yeah. There's a story that I've told before, and I wanted to repeat it if you don't mind. It was an incident that happened to me in the mid-90s. I would go to these meetings in Sydney. They were called Pagans in the Pub. So as the name implies, you'd have a group of pagans getting together and going into a pub. A pub is like a sports bar for those not familiar with the term. And at the time, the start time was a little bit fuzzy. People would get there when they got there, but the finish time was set in stone. Everyone would leave at the time that we were supposed to leave because people would jump onto the train. This pub was near the train station, near Central Train Station, because they wanted to go home to watch Buffy. Vampire Slayer, like the number one TV series. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is that we would have a topic for discussion, and they would choose an item which would be the talking stick. So while you were holding that talking stick, you were able to talk, and no one was able to talk over the top of you. And then once you'd finished, you then passed the talking stick to someone else, and then they would talk. So on this one occasion, we were talking about pantheons. So bear in mind, this is Sydney in the mid-90s. So there were a number of people who talked about the pantheons that they work with or pantheons that they were interested in. There were a couple of people who said that they were interested in the Celtic gods but didn't know much about them. There were a couple of people who said that they were interested in the Egyptian gods, and they were like slowly learning a little bit about them. There was one guy who I remember, he said that he would go to the ocean and he would feel the presence of a god in the ocean, in the waves. And that was the god that he worked with. But the pantheon that kept coming up again and again and again and again was the Greek pantheon. So many people there said that they were familiar with the Greek gods. And the thing is, you have to remember, up until a few decades ago, the most powerful or the most, not serious isn't the right word, but the most highly regarded education you could aspire to was a classical education.
Yeah.
And that involved the study of Greek and Roman literature. So as a result, you have Greek and Roman themes permeating the arts. So we've already mentioned Hollywood movies, but you also have Greek and Roman themes in painting, in classical painting, in classical sculptures. So everyone's familiar with it. So that, again, impressed on me how important the Greek gods were. So the pagan scene in Sydney has changed since then. People have learned more about the Celtic gods, the Roman gods, the Egyptian gods. But at the time, Sydney in the mid-90s, the most important pantheon, just looking at that particular snapshot, that 20 or so people who were there, most people there were working with the Greek gods. So that impressed on me how important the Greek gods were to people who were into alternate spirituality.
What made you choose, of all the expressions that blossomed around the idea of Olympus, what made you choose ceremonial magic?
I started off a Catholic, and I had the Jerusalem Bible. It was an early version of the Jerusalem Bible, and that would have the names of God in it. So it would have Yahweh, which is an incorrect transliteration of the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God, Yod Heh Vav Heh. It had Elohim. It had all these various names. So I stumbled onto the Kabbalah. And it's so incredibly familiar to me because I knew all the names of power. They were all taken from the Bible. And if you're interested in finding out more about that, there's a guy called Arya Kaplan who was both a rabbi and he had a PhD in physics. I think it was in physics. So basically, you had someone who had a very analytical mind, and he would apply it to religion. So he would talk about the crossover between Kabbalah and the Bible. So he would talk about the various names of power, where they came from, and everything else. So I found myself very comfortable with the Kabbalah. So it was like something that I could get into coming from a Catholic background. So the Kabbalah then led me to Golden Dawn magic, largely through Donald Michael Craig's book, Modern Magic, because there are all these, you look at the Lesser Banishment Ritual of the Pentagram, it's peppered with Hebrew names of power that I'm familiar with from the Bible. So like I said, I got into Golden Dawn magic. I developed an interest in Thelema, also Marthian magic. But then I found myself moving back towards more and more ancient systems of magic, and I wound up arriving at the magic of late antiquity, Greco-Egyptian magic, which is actually the subject of my first book. The reason for that is that when you look at the spells that we find in the Greek magical papyri, they're written in Koine Greek. And that was the Greek that was used. Koine means common Greek. It was the Greek that was spoken at the time of Jesus. And it's also the version of Greek that was used for the Bible. We know how to pronounce Koine Greek.
In
so
modern
as a result,
Greek, In modern Greek, it's skini, and it means like practical, that which is used, you know, so like a common tongue.
Yeah, okay. So basically, you can look at the various names of power in the Greek magic papyri, and we know how to pronounce them. Whereas if you compare that to, you look at Egyptian magic and Babylonian magic, we're not quite sure how to pronounce Egyptian names of power, you know, Egyptian god names, and also Babylonian god names. There's always that element of doubt. Scholars do the best that they can, but they're not quite sure. So in order to pronounce Egyptian terms, they look at Coptic, which is the last flowering of the Egyptian language, and then they try to project backwards and from Coptic try to come up with their best guess as to how the ancient Egyptians pronounced their language. So I found that I resonated with Greco-Egyptian magic. So Greco-Egyptian magic consists of a number of magical streams. You've got, as the name implies, there's Greek and there's Egyptian, but there's also Sumerian, Babylonian, Jewish, and there's a very light sprinkling of Christianity. And so by getting into that particular modality, I then started to develop more of an interest in the various streams that made up Greco-Egyptian magic, and I found myself immersing myself more and more in Greek religion, which actually gave rise to the second book, which I wrote, Hellenismos. So I mean, that's sort of a hand-waving explanation of how I got to where I am now. But there are all these little signposts that got me to where I am. But I feel very comfortable with what I'm doing at the moment. I've been basically on the same path for the last 20 years now, and I feel quite happy on it. Yeah. Prior to that, I was playing around with systems of ceremonial magic, playing around with chaos magic, a little bit directionless, not really dabbling in things, but not totally happy with what I'm doing. Now I feel that I'm on a definite path, and I'm quite happy to share that path with anyone who's interested.
Wow, that is awesome. I read a book many, many years ago called The Greek Kabbalah, which shows how the influence of Greek thought impacted the Kabbalah and Kabbalistic teachings. I have to dig that out now.
Yeah, I'm actually quite familiar with that book. I used it as one of the sources in my book, Greco-Egyptian Magic. The guy who penned it is actually in the OTO, and his contention was that everything that you find in the Kabbalah comes from Greek sources. So he's basically, it's almost, I don't want to say anti-Semitic, but he's downplaying the Jewish elements in the Kabbalah. He's basically saying that everything came from the Greeks. But there's no doubt that once these Greek themes came into the Kabbalah, they were then developed. So, but
during the time, during the Hellenistic era, when all these ideas were interacting and mutating, theosophy also came to be during that time, the Theosophia, and the concept of exoteric and esoteric teachings, which went underground during the Christian prosecutions, and kind of reflowered again during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Brandy's book is really excellent in tracing that thread from its beginnings to its being underground to its resurfacing and what it's produced until then. But back then, they didn't seem to really have a problem with there being different expressions of the divine truth. We seem to have developed that as we move forward in time, increasingly more to the detriment of our culture.
I think that one of the greatest contributions of Alexander the Great was that he didn't do what other conquerors had done. When he conquered various countries, he didn't kill off the intelligentsia. He didn't impose his religious ideas on people or philosophical ideas. But all he did was he introduced a common language, which was Greek. So he encouraged people to just express themselves in Greek. So it got to the stage where if you looked at a text written from the far-flung reaches of the Hellenistic Empire, you could not tell if it was written by a Greek who had immersed himself in the culture of the country that he was living in, or if you were reading something that was written by a Hellenized citizen of that country. So you were a citizen of the Hellenistic Empire by virtue of education,
right?
Not by birth. All you had to do was to express yourself in Greek. So that led to this huge cross-cultural mixing. You had all these streams coming together, philosophical ideas from the far-flung reaches of the Hellenistic Empire, and the epicenter of that mixing was Alexandria. You had the Alexandria Library, where you had all these writings from the ancient world coming together in the one spot, and you had incredible philosophical schools that came into being as a result. You had Gnosticism, you had Hermeticism, you had Mithraism. All these religious and philosophical movements came into being. It was a very exciting period in history. And it's a period I'd love to see again, but I don't know if it'll ever happen.
Yeah, I know it's very disheartening to know that 2,000 years ago, people were able to attain this until they lost it to fanaticism. And now, we've created a global communication system greater than anything that antiquity has seen, maybe even rivaling the Atlantean legends we have. And yet we too, fanaticism is threatening to destroy it.
That's true, but what I'm seeing is, like, in America a few years ago, 76% of people identified as Christian. But what's happening is that the number of people identifying as Christian is reducing every year. And what's happening is that the younger people are leaving Christianity. They're leaving for things that have much more meaning for them. It's actually much the same sort of process that happens to Judaism a few decades ago. What happened was that young Jewish kids weren't getting what they wanted in synagogues. So they started looking towards Eastern modalities. They wanted to get into meditation. They wanted to experience things. So the rabbis, seeing what was happening, started saying to them, look, you don't have to look towards the East. Everything that you want, you can actually find in the Kabbalah. You can find in your own backyard, basically. So there are meditative techniques, there's magic, there's techniques for visualization. So the Kabbalah became popular purely to bring kids back. You know, the Kabbalah actually fell into disrepute. From memory, it was the year 666. There was a great Sabbatai Tzvi, who was a Kabbalist, and he worked wonders. And a number of Jews at the time looked towards him as a possible Messiah figure.
Uh-huh.
And he would work wonders. He was a Kabbalist. Then what happened was that I'm going on memory here. This is really, I haven't talked about him in many years. So I think he was captured by the Turkish Sultan, and he was basically threatened with death unless he converted to Islam. And he did. He converted. So a lot of Jews felt betrayed by him, and they won't even mention his name. He's referred to as that one rather than his name, Sabbatai Tzvi. And so as he fell into disrepute, the Kabbalah fell into disrepute as well. So it was only when young people a few decades ago started to leave the synagogues that the rabbis started to bring the Kabbalah back. I mean, that's a very simplified picture, but now the Kabbalah's taken off in a huge way. You've got people like Madonna walking around wearing red ribbons around their wrists, or red string, I should say, around their wrists. So there's this resurgence of spirituality.
That I seem to remember that tale quite well. During my, my late teens, early 20s and onwards, I explored many spiritual paths. They all eventually brought me back to Olympus. So now, although I have a curiosity and I'll, you know, find out about things, I no longer need to leave Olympus. Olympus was there in the beginning, and through all my travels, the road led back to Olympus. So I'm content where I am as well.
I think it is good to travel.
Yes.
And find out what is the best thing for you. In ancient times, Herodotus claimed that everything the Greeks had came from the Egyptians. So their system of religion, everything was taken from the Egyptians. And what many people aren't aware of is that in ancient times, there was this thing called spiritual tourism, where wealthy Greek men would travel to places like Egypt. They'd see how the Egyptians would practice their religion. They'd visit the pyramids, they'd various temples and the like. They'd also go off to places like Babylon as well, but Egypt was very close to Greece. So spiritual tourism was absolutely huge. But the thing is that you then go off, you experience things, and one thing I love about the Greeks is that they would get an understanding of gods in various nations, and then they would describe those gods in the names of their own gods. So they would see overlaps between the various gods. So it was like they invented the idea of archetypes, you know, centuries before Jung did.
Right.
So that's one thing that a lot of Reconstructionists sort of come to blows over. They wonder whether there's a difference between the gods of various nations. So, for instance, you look at something like someone like Zeus. Zeus was a storm god, the leader of all the gods. But yet there's a close correspondence with him and someone like Jupiter, Marduk, Perun. And someone came up with, this is a really cute analogy, just imagine you have a situation where a storm breaks out in Italy. So Jupiter is in charge of that storm. That storm then travels to Greece. And then as soon as it gets to Greece, Jupiter lets it go and Zeus takes over. Then that storm travels to Babylon, and Zeus lets go of it, and Marduk takes over. Then that storm travels north, and it goes to the Slavic countries. Perun takes over, and then it travels across to Germany, you know, the northern countries, and then Thor takes over. The point is, it's still the same storm, but yet you've got a number of storm gods looking over it. So you can look at them as being discrete entities. They all have discrete myths, but there are all these similarities between them. I think the idea of archetypes does have a lot going for it.
Me too. But again, there are... that really is a good way of looking at it. Or you can look at it as some of the ancients did. It's the same god behind a different cultural mask. And that by studying other cultures, one of the first things they did was equate the gods. So they had a way of communicating and establishing commonality.
Exactly. And so the Greeks were well ahead of their time in doing that.
I remember reading The Hero with a Thousand Faces and The Masks of God by Joseph Campbell. That definitely influenced and informed my way of looking at things, and it expanded what the ancients did. In addition to that, Jung and his archetypes and the neo-Jungians like Hillman, they further informed it. So it then became, what path are you attracted to? They're all like spokes in a wheel. You know, they start in the same place and they end up in the same place, but it's how you get from point A to point B. If you look at it as masks, cultural masks, then it's a delightful journey of like playing hide and seek with the divine. And I enjoyed that aspect of my journey.
Absolutely. Another way of looking at it is as paths leading up a mountain. So there are numerous paths to the top of the mountain, and it doesn't matter which path you're on. so long as you're moving up towards the top of the mountain. The view is the same at the top. So it's a matter of finding the path which agrees with you. That's sort of, I think, because we've broken away from the religion that we were brought up in, it's been incredibly freeing because we've been able to explore these numerous paths. And for you, you found yourself being drawn towards working with the Greek gods at an early age, the Olympian gods, but then you explored all these other modalities, and then you found yourself coming back to the Greek gods. In my case, it's, you know, much the same thing. I found myself attracted to Greek mythology and the like because of movies, just through watching a lot of television.
Right.
And then I had that episode in the mid-90s where I realized just how important the Greek gods were. And there are all sorts of articles online where they talk about various movies that have Greek mythological influences. So Hollywood is heavily saturated with Greek mythology. And for those who find themselves getting into those movies and resonating with them on a very deep level, I think they may well find themselves wanting to investigate the reality underneath them and getting into at least Greek mythology and hopefully working with Greek religion. We can't downplay the influence of Hollywood. Hollywood's huge. Everyone goes off and watches movies, and these days it's so easy. You can stream movies. You can watch whatever movie you want in seconds. So you can immerse yourself in Greek mythology for hours and hours, and that may well lead to something far more real.
And even if it doesn't, even if somebody doesn't want to take it further into the spiritual or the psychological realms, they can spend all their free time on Olympus just through books and movies and comic books and other pop video games. If you fill your time with these, then you can reach Olympus on that level.
Yeah. There's no one path which is better than any other path. My attitude towards the gods is, while it'd be great if people worship the gods in a traditional manner, if they find another system that works for them, then by all means go with that. Like, you could be a Wiccan, for instance. So you call the quarters, you cast the circle, you do everything else, and call them the Greek gods, and the gods come to you. If that works for you, great. There are things that we don't want to bring back that the ancient Greeks had. Obviously, we don't want to bring back their social system, their system of inequity, where you had slavery, where women were subjugated. I don't think we want to. Well, as a vegetarian, I certainly don't want public animal sacrifice. But the thing is, you can have bloodless offerings to the gods, and there are numerous precedents for that. So, I mean, that's one of my things. I always talk about, you know, using bloodless offerings, going for frankincense or statues or pouring out libations and the like, or rather than have an animal, have a cake in the shape of an animal and offer that. You know, it all works just as well. It's the intention. It's whether you're coming from the heart. I mean, you could slay an animal as the ancients did, but if your heart's not in the right place, if it's not communing with the god you're trying to contact, all you're doing is killing an animal. It's not going to bring you any closer to the god. But, you know, you can throw a little grain of frankincense, and if you have a deep yearning towards that particular god, you will contact that god. It's the heart connection that's the most important.
Now, are you attuned mostly to one Olympian, or do you have like a mini pantheon or the entire pantheon or beyond the pantheon to all the other divine creatures that exist in the Olympian schema?
I'm like most other people insofar as there are certain gods that I will feel closer to than others. Like, I tend to work with the Greek planetary gods.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them are Olympians and others aren't. So So in my case, you know, I work with Celine, who's not an Olympian. I work with Hermes, who is. I work with Aphrodite, who is. I work with Helios, who's not. But I could always substitute Apollo if I wanted to stick with an Olympian. I work with Ares, who is. I work with Zeus, and I work with Kronos, who isn't. I've worked with other Olympian gods as well, but, you know, with the system that I work with, I find myself working with those planetary gods because I try to attune myself to the planets every day. But I do work with the other gods as well. But what happens is you find yourself being drawn to some of those gods to a greater extent than to others. And over the years, I've come across a number of people who've described themselves as priests or priestesses of various gods. I've met a number of women who have told me that they're priestesses of Aphrodite. I've met guys who have told me that they work with Poseidon. Janet, who you know, her son, probably shouldn't really be talking about him, but he thought he was Poseidon because he had a great love for the Percy Jackson series, and yeah, he loves the beach and everything else. But then when he went to Greece for a holiday, he found that it was actually Apollo who was calling to him. And so now he's a devotee of Apollo. And so he's one example of someone who started off with the Percy Jackson books and the movies, also, you know, Xena, Warrior Princess and everything else, and now he has a genuine devotion for Apollo. I had another experience. So I was in Minnesota, and I was giving workshops there, and I had a woman come up to me, and she told me that she had a teenage son, and he really wanted to come to my workshops. And he said that when he had a look at the schedule, the only things that he was interested in were the workshops that I was giving him, because so many of them were Greek themed. And she said, he'll be really saved and please let him go. And I said, yeah, sure. And he sat there in the front row. He was, not that there were rows, it was a camping type event, but he sat there near the front. He listened very quietly, attentively. And when he did ask questions, they were all insightful questions. He was a really nice guy. And guess what? He was another Percy Jackson fan. So he started with the Percy Jackson books. And I remember, you know, my parting conversation with him and his mother was I recommended a couple of books on Greek mythology just so that they could investigate the actual reality of the gods that they are working with. But again, you know, it all comes down to Hollywood and you know, the Harry Potter books as well. They got so many kids interested in witchcraft, so they would then explore witchcraft as a result of what they were seeing in the Harry Potter books. So obviously, you know, you work out pretty quickly that the results you're going to get aren't as spectacular as the special effects make out. But there is reality to them. There is you feel that it all is real, that it is genuine. You are actually contacting an intelligence and a power greater than your own. And it's quite exciting when you first make that little breakthrough.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yes, the popular entertainment is kind of like a net, and as you pointed out, I actually wrote a paper for this in college maybe 30, 40 years ago about how the popular entertainment is kind of like a net, and that's what keeps the mythology alive. And every now and then you get somebody who wants to look into what the reality is behind the stories that they're immersed in, and those are the ones who will go back and you know, basically pursue a more scholarly route. And they also write scholarly things, too, that increase our knowledge. So you need both. You need to be living in the popular culture and to address itself to the people of our age. And then you need those that will, you know, rediscover, think about, and preserve the lore. So each serves its purpose, and they're just as important as each other. The scholarship without the living mythology would be dry. The entertainment without the scholarship behind it wouldn't be focused on Olympus. So you do need both.
Yeah, I totally agree. In the blogs which I write, what I do is I look at current issues, and then I pick out gods. Many of them are Olympic gods, and look at how those gods can be applied to assist in a particular scenario. And certain gods lend themselves particularly well to the situations we find ourselves in. I personally resonate very heavily with Zeus. I've got a close relationship with Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
But the god which rules this age would have to be Hermes.
Yes, definitely.
Because if you think about what characterizes this age, you mentioned before that we're able to communicate with people around the world, which is something the ancients couldn't do. So you've got communication, you've got world travel. I can hop on a plane and be back in Sydney in 17 hours.
Right.
17 hours. Mind you, there's 2 weeks of quarantine in a hotel. At the moment, there's a shutdown again because of the Delta variant in Sydney. So the shutdown started on Monday, and it's going to go for 2 weeks. So I don't know if they're letting anyone into the country, but all these businesses and the like are shut down. I would have to have a very good reason for going back there. And I really don't want to until COVID's over, if it ever will be over. I mean, who knows? We've got the Delta variant now. We may have something even nastier in a few months' time. Things are really bad. So basically, for communication and also for world travel, Hermes is the god that you turn to. I'm very into agriculture and trying to stick with organic foods and avoid genetically modified foods. So there's Demeter who you work with. She's the goddess who looks after agriculture, you know, growing of cereals and the like. Anything to do with the oceans. You know that oceans are being overfished, ecosystems are being destroyed in the ocean. So Poseidon is the god that you'd call on for assistance. You know, the Olympians lend themselves to so many projects that you want to work to. I mean, like, on the theatre panel, we've talked about various activist things, the activist projects we've gotten into. Brandy, you know, Brandy Williams is heavily into activism. And again, you can enhance the work that you're doing by calling on the relevant gods.
Yeah, yes, definitely so. I also work primarily with the planetary gods, and you know, whether they be Olympians, Titans, primordials, I tend to stick with the planetary gods. And I've also been working with the elemental gods and the gods of directions as well, increasingly more so this past couple of years since we started the Theurgy panel.
Very cool. One point which I wanted to make, and this is something that I'm not sure how many people are aware of this, but the Greeks did not have a word for religion. They didn't need to, because in this day and age, we separate religion from our secular life. For the ancient Greeks, there was no separation.
The Greek gods
were integrated seamlessly into society. So before every meal, you'd make offerings to Hestia, to Agathos Daimon. You had your household gods before every endeavor. You'd be calling in relevant gods, and you did it without even thinking. It was just something that you did. It was just a part of your life, and I think that is a wonderful way to go, so that whenever you want to engage in any sort of project, just think of the god that's most relevant to what you're doing. I mean, during the whole COVID pandemic, which we're suffering, you know, it's wonderful to call on Hygeia, for hygiene practices when washing your hands. You call on Asclepius if you're sick, as the ancients did. Apollo was the plague god. So again, he's another god that you, amongst other things, in later times, he started to be associated more with music, divination alike. But the earliest manifestations of Apollo was as a plague god. So again, he's someone you can call on. There's a god for pretty well every situation you find yourself in, and they are still relevant now. They're still just as relevant now as they were 2,500 years ago.
That's very true. Even Hercules, who was usually associated with bodybuilding in gyms these days, he was known as Alexikakos, the averter of ills, so he could be called in. And during the turn of the millenniums into the common era, he was best known for water therapies and health spas. Leonidas in the 300, when they went to Thermopylae, Thermopylae yeah. was a vacation resort where people went to get treatments in hot baths. So the picture people have through the movie and through the comic books is not really accurate. It's imagine if this took place in the Catskills near resorts. That's pretty much a more accurate picture.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we've reached the end of this conversation, but I'm heartened that there will be very many. Thank you for helping to launch Voice of Olympus. And how can people enter the world of Tony Mrazwicki? How can they find you, explore your works, and contact you?
Easiest way to contact me is Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. I also have a Pathos blog where I explore current issues, and I've also done a number of reviews. I reviewed Brandy's book, Brandy Williams' book, just recently, and I'm going to be reviewing a couple of Bruce's books. Bruce is better known as Apollonius on the show, so I'm going to be reviewing those, and I'll be interviewing him. So for me, Hercules, the greatest gift that you've given me is you've kind of given me a family of sorts, people who are on the same path as my own, and we're supporting each other, we're encouraging each other. We're all trying to help Brandy with her new book. I want
right.
to give a bit of help with the books that he's written. And I think it's wonderful that we're all on the same path. I've also reviewed Jean-Louis, a text that Jean-Louis wrote, his Pagan Almanac, the ultimate Pagan Almanac. I think it's great that we're all on the same path and we're all trying to help each other. We're all trying to make a little contribution, and for me that contribution is to bring the gods back, have people working with the gods, not necessarily have everyone, but just the right people. If anyone feels a calling to them, then by all means work with them. If they're happy worshiping the gods they're worshiping now, great, more power to them. For those who aren't, consider the Greek gods.
Thank you, that is my desire as well, that we form a band of companions, a spiritual family, and that we all serve the gods in our own way and share it with the world, and what people choose is what they choose, but we've done a responsibility and put it out there.
Exactly, very well put.
Thank you so very much, Tony. Have a wonderful evening, and I look forward to our next conversation. Thanks to everyone who's joined us tonight, whether you listened live or whether you're going to listen later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Tony.
Thanks, Hercules.